Welcome to Property Litigation Bites by Haag & Wolf, delivering the latest analysis of property litigation trends to UK landowners, developers, landlords, and tenants.
I'm Matt Pugh, founder and managing partner of Haag & Wolf, a law firm specialising exclusively in property litigation. In this inaugural episode of our Property Litigation Bites podcast, we discuss an upcoming Law Commission consultation on the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, the outcomes of which could have a significant impact on the commercial leasehold market. I'm joined today by my business partner and fellow property litigation solicitor, Richard Robinson. We'll be introducing the Act as it currently stands, looking at how the consultation might affect commercial landlords and tenants in real terms, and giving our predictions on the changes that may come out of this process. Why don't we start by talking a bit about our backgrounds?
Thanks, Matt. So I am a real estate litigation lawyer and have undertaken a great variety of work over the years in relation to all kinds of disputes relating to property, predominantly focused on corporate commercial real estate matters. And included within that has been a lot of advice given for both corporate landlords and corporate occupiers on what we are going to talk about today, being the renewal and termination of business tenancies. And what about you then, Matt?
Like you, Richard, I specialise exclusively in property litigation, and I've done so for over 23 years. I started my career managing the lease renewal process for a major pub company, and since then I've been regularly involved in 1954 Act cases, including those affecting household name retailers and clients in the manufacturing and leisure sectors. Now that we've introduced ourselves, Richard, do you want to introduce the 1954 Act for our listeners?
Yes, sure. So what is the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954? So it's a piece of legislation, the second part of which is particularly relevant to business tenants and has at its heart a concept called security of tenure. So what is that, this security of tenure? It's effectively the automatic right for business tenants to renew their tenancies when their original agreed period of occupancy is coming to an end. While landlords and tenants can contract out of the Act and stop such an automatic renewal to the business tenancies so that the parties are just dealing with market forces, if the business tenancies are not contracted out of this Act, then there will only be very limited situations. For example, if the landlord wishes to redevelop their property, when landlord can resist this automatic renewal of the tenant's business tenancy. And so it is this, the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, which the Law Commission has launched this consultation on. That's perhaps unsurprising. A lot of people that I work with think that it's a particularly old bit of legislation. It's coming up to 70 years old. When it was first introduced, you know, we were talking about the mass vaccination of children of polio. We're talking about the end of British military occupation of the Suez Canal. And, you know, I don't think, Matt, that even you will be able to remember any of this. But perhaps you could explain a little bit about why the Law Commission has decided itself that we should be consulting on the Act.
As you say, Richard, it's 70 years since the Act became law, and a lot has changed since then. The commercial leasehold market is completely different, and it's quite right to review these things every so many years and to see whether it still is fit for purpose. What the Law Commission is trying to do at this stage is to just reassess whether the 1954 Act, in particular this principle of security of tenure, is still relevant in today's modern world. And they've decided to approach the consultation in two phases. The first phase, which is open to consultation until the 19th of February, so in other words, anybody with an interest in this can provide their views to the Law Commission before the 19th of February. The first stage is to look at security of tenure. So the Law Commission are asking the question, or considering the question, what should we do about security of tenure? Should we go back to the 1950s and make security of tenure mandatory so there's no ability to contract out of the Act at all, which would be very nice for business tenants, perhaps? Or do we go the complete other way and abolish security of tenure? So tenants who sign up for a lease of, say, 5 years, at the end of those 5 years, they have to go unless they can negotiate a new tenancy. Or do we do something similar to what we've got now, where it's a contracting out procedure. So the default position is that the tenants have security of tenure, but if the landlord and tenant agree, they can go for a process to contract out of the act, as we have now, but potentially changing the process to make that work more smoothly, perhaps. Or alternatively, the fourth option, do we switch to a contracting in procedure where the default position is that the Act doesn't apply, but the party's going to choose to contract in to make the Act apply? So these are the questions that are all being considered at the moment in terms of security of tenure. And the second question I'm asking is about the scope of the Act. So should the Act apply to all business tenancies, or should it be limited to certain kinds of business tenancies or certain durations? And the Law Commission have looked at what's happening in places like the Netherlands and Scotland and Ireland and Australia and different places. And there are a range of different approaches. So it could be, for example, that security of tenure should only be available to retailers in the high street. That is an option to do it that way. Or it could be that security of tenure should only be available for leases that are longer than a certain duration in time. And the other issue for them to consider is, in relation to the scope of the Act, is the exclusion. So there are certain sorts of tenancy that are expressly excluded from the Act. The first kind are tenancies that are covered by a different statutory regime, so perhaps agricultural holdings or telecoms leases. And there are also exclusions of tenancies that are 6 months in duration or less. Perhaps those should be changed so that the exclusions only apply to tenancies that are 12 months or less or 18 months or less. These are all questions that the Law Commission are considering and they're inviting comments on. And the way they're approaching it is to not start looking at the detail of the reform until they actually have decided which is the way to go with security of tenure, which is the way to go with the scope of the Act. But there are lots of arguments for and against different approaches, and there are winners and losers in those scenarios. So I wonder, Richard, what your thoughts are on security of tenure and perhaps some of the pros and cons of different models.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So there's quite a bit to unpack there. I think it's probably worth us discussing a little bit about why was this security of tenure concept, the idea of giving business tenants the automatic right to renew unless something else was done differently and expressly. Why was that created in the first place? What was the point? Why were we intervening in the free market? And why were we saying, well, tenants should have this right? So, for example, was it because it costs money for tenants to fit out their premises, to build up goodwill? And then, if they're needing to then decant and go somewhere else at the end of quite a short period of time, to 3 to 5 years or whatever, then this was costing tenants a lot of money and it was affecting businesses. And maybe not just their own businesses, but their suppliers and other people as well.
No, it's a very good point. If you open a cafe on the high street and signing up to a 2-year lease, you're paying for the fit out, as you say, you're paying to establish your brand in that location. People get used to stopping at your cafe on the way to work for a coffee. And a huge part of the value of that business is the location. And if at the end of the 2-year period, you're faced with having to move somewhere else, that's going to be immensely disruptive to your business, and it might actually put you off starting in the first place. And I guess, back in the 1950s, post-Second World War, part of the thinking here might have been to try and boost the business world, try and encourage people to start up businesses, which is kind of relevant to today's age with the high street not being in the best shape. Maybe this is now a similar time for different reasons where we need to support businesses in the high street, and perhaps a beefed up form of security of tenure maybe helps that. But I'm not sure whether that actually panned out in reality, because of course, if you're a commercial landlord and that is the scenario, then maybe you're going to be less willing to rent out your property, knowing that you've got no certainty as to what happens.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the tenant side, but what are the problems for the landlords in having tenants who do have security of tenure? I mean, for example, it could be the fact that in certain situations, they genuinely want to redevelop, or they genuinely want to occupy the premises for their own purposes. And while the Landlord and Tenants Act, it does provide grounds for a landlord to be able to do that, it can be quite a long and drawn out process, which needs court proceedings and a lot of money invested in it simply to get a tenant out. Are there other issues such as that that landlords are facing with this concept of security of tenure?
It's a very good point, in particular when it comes to development. So the reality, and we know this as litigators, if, for example, a landlord wants a commercial property back in order to redevelop it, and of course there's a mechanism for doing that under the Act, the reality is if a tenant wishes to dispute that ground of opposition for redevelopment, you can then end up in court proceedings, and those court proceedings can go on for a considerable amount of time, in some case years when you include the notice period. In the meantime, the landlord has no real certainty as to when exactly they're going to get the property back, or perhaps even if they're going to get the property back. And they've somehow got to try and synchronise that with planning and with, you know, lining up contractors and generally getting things ready in order to develop. It can be a bit of a nightmare, really. So it's not great for commercial landlords at all. And of course, there are other ways of doing this, which don't seem to be that common at the moment, but there's nothing to stop the parties contracting to do this. So you could have the ability for a landlord, for example, to terminate a lease in particular circumstances, for example, if they want to redevelop. And likewise, you could have a contractual provision entitling a tenant to have a new lease under contractual agreement rather than under statute. So there are other ways of achieving the same aim if the parties agree. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts, Richard, as to whether or not that is as good as the Act, or perhaps it wouldn't work as well.
Yeah, I mean, We do occasionally, don't we, see leases come across our desk which do have that option to renew. Now, they tend to be older leases, harking back to an older time, and they have their own problems themselves because, of course, it all depends on the drafting of those leases as to how clear it is. And as we know, there can be a dispute about anything. And that really makes me kind of go back to a different point, really, which is we were talking before about this is a 70-year-old Act. But actually, is that testament to its success? We understand to a point where we are. If there's some radical change now through the Law Commission, then doesn't that mean, a bit like in the telecoms world, for example, that we're going to have to start again and we're going to have to gain lots of clarity through lots of expensive litigation, and business tenants and landlords aren't going to know where they stand?
Yeah, my personal view is that at a conceptual level, security of tenure works. It doesn't need re-engineering. What it perhaps needs is the process improving so that some of the traps are removed, certain things are clarified. That would be useful, and everybody in the process would benefit from that. There's a great opportunity to do that, but it doesn't need sort of throwing away and starting again. I don't actually think there has even been a major call by industry to review the 54 Act. This is something that the Law Commission do from time to time, as it is sensible to do. But I'm not aware of any sort of major lobbying to change it, because essentially, at a high level, it works pretty well. Yeah. Have you got any, you know, are there any particular aspects of the workings of the Act, Richard, that you think could be improved?
Yeah, I think there are, and the main one probably being the actual contracting out process. We've gone through different machinations of this. So, you know, back in the day, you'd have to go to the county court to get an order to be able to exclude the tenancy from benefiting from the security of tenure. rights under the 1954 Act. But we now have two different ways to contract out of the 54 Act in terms of sending warning notices and statutory declarations, depending how close you are to completing your lease. It's relatively complicated. We've had a case relatively recently about how maybe you have to fill in these forms and do these various things. But actually, why can't we just put it in the lease itself? Why do we need to go off to the county court? And why do we need to be serving warning notices and the rest? Of course, the purpose of those originally was to flag to the tenant, this is a really important right you have. Are you okay about waiving it and not having the benefit of this security of tenure, this automatic right to renewal? But my view is that it is not a massively complicated concept to understand. And if it can simply be written in to a lease and it is clear in the wording itself, well, it's a bit beware for me. The tenant, even if they're not taking legal advice on it, should at least be reading the lease themselves. So I think that's something which could be tidied up rather than having this confusion sometimes as to what needs to be served or how and how these notices need to be drafted. Why don't we just simply have a clause in the lease which deals with that? I don't know whether you have any thoughts on that yourself.
I think that would be a good idea. I mean, there needs to be a way of making sure the tenant understands. But it could, for example, be that there's a standard form of wording that's inserted where they're acknowledging that they understand what it means. It could potentially have to be countersigned by a solicitor. So there are ways of doing it, and there are issues. There are, you know, a number of cases, as you say, that have been through the courts. I've been involved in some of these things where there's argument over whether the contracting out procedure has been followed properly. And nobody wants that. It's not helpful to anybody. It needs to be a simple process. So that could be improved, I'm sure. One of the other things I think that could possibly be improved is, you know, recognising that we're in a modern world and people tend to send emails rather than letters. If you're going to write to somebody and post a letter, chances are they're probably not at their destination. They're probably working from home. So why not serve notices by email? What's wrong with that? As long as people are satisfied that it's been received and those sort of checks and balances are in place, then why not serve by email? So it would be helpful if the Act could clarify that, perhaps. Also, you know, the other thing that you get is that agreeing extensions of the deadline to apply for court in Section 25 notices, for example, it has to be done in writing. There is debate as to whether or not an exchange of emails is adequate. It probably is, but no one's completely sure, and the Act could quite easily clarify that that is okay. The only other thing I think is probably worth discussing briefly is the terms of the new lease that the court could order and whether there needs to be some clarification there. You know, essentially, the law is that the terms of a new lease will be the same as the terms of the old lease, unless there's a really good reason. Then the rents will be market rent. But things have moved on. There's all sorts of requirements in relation to green leases and such. And there are, you know, developments of trends such as turnover rent. Turnover rent is quite popular, but there's no clarity at all in the Act as to whether or not the court can order turnover rent. And again, rent-free periods, very, very common. A tenant not having to pay rent for maybe 6 or 12 months so that they can use the money they would have paid as rent to fit out the premises, for example. Very, very common in the market, but not really something that the court can order, or at least it's not clear that they can order these things. I wonder whether there needs to be some clarity as to what the court can order when it comes to the terms of a new lease to, you know, basically be a bit more modern and up to date.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, particularly on energy efficiency and MEES, and supposedly the fact that we are trying to cut down on carbon emissions and that EPC ratings should be increasing, in the sense of it will not be lawful to rent out premises unless you're able to achieve a certain level of EPC, and it's only supposed to get more stringent. Well, how do you facilitate that? And is the Landlord and Tenant Act and renewal an opportunity to do so? So redevelopment, you know, this means and is an obligation of the landlord. It's got nothing truly to do with the tenant. Now, a tenant may totally buy into it, and they may therefore allow the landlord to carry out changes to the property, which makes the property more energy efficient. They may even be willing to put some money into to help it. But if you're going to say to a landlord, well, it's going to be unlawful to let your property, then if it doesn't reach a certain energy efficiency level, then there's got to be the mechanism for the landlord to be able to carry out those works. And it seems to me that's something which, you know, could be added into the Landlord and Tenant Act and provide that guidance for the judges, as you say, as to what a landlord should be able to do. It may be it happens under a redevelopment ground, or it may not. It may be that you put a contractual term within a lease which allows a landlord to carry out energy efficiency repairs, whether there's any recovery from the tenant or not. You know, that isn't something which you're going to necessarily see in older leases, of course, because we didn't have this concept of, well, mees and obligations on landlords in the same way with your older term leases. So I do think guidance generally would be helpful. There's also been cases recently about break conditionality and what kind of break clauses and options to break the lease during the term you can have. Again, it would be helpful to have a little bit more clarity. The only thing that I would say, and I don't know whether you would agree with this, is that there is a danger about being too prescriptive. You know, every different property and every landlord and tenant party is going to be different. And what the current system allows is looking at each case on their own merits. It's about fact and degree, and it's about a balancing exercise about if we're going to change the lease from what it was previously, what may be the potential disadvantages, financial or otherwise, to the landlord? What are the potential advantages to the landlord? And vice versa, if we're talking about a tenant's proposed terms. So I do think that being too prescriptive is dangerous. And that is where the judges step in. And while that creates a certain level of uncertainty, it does allow people to take a bit more of a sophisticated approach and to be able to argue out their individual circumstances in a way. If it was just all written in black and white, we could have other problems.
Richard, thank you for a really interesting discussion.
And thank you.
And thank you to all listeners. As a reminder, before we go, the Law Commission wants feedback from business tenants, landlords, representative groups, property professionals, judges, academics, researchers and members of the public on the recent consultation. You can have your say on the 1954 Act through a form linked in the podcast description. The deadline for providing a response is the 19th of February 2025. If you have any questions or concerns, please contact me or Richard through LinkedIn or at hello@hargandwolf.co.uk.
Thank you for listening to Property Litigation Bites. Haag & Wolf is an award-winning UK law firm specialising exclusively in property litigation and disputes. If you would like to discuss any of the issues covered in this episode, please contact us at hello@hargandwolf.co.uk. You can also find us on LinkedIn. Visit www.hargandwolf.co.uk for further insight and analysis.